Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the Grapes of Wrath revisited, and later, a new cyber czar. But first, with General Motors expected to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on Monday, GM stock dropped below $1 a share for the first time since 1933 today. But there may be a little bit of good news for GM as well. There could be a deal in the works to sell GM Europe ahead of Monday's expected bankruptcy filing. The BBC's business correspondent Mark Gregory is following that part of the story from London. Mark, what's the latest?
Well, it's been a day of extremely confusing developments. As you probably know, there are two bidders in the frame to take control of General Motors' European operations. One of them is Magna International, a Canadian car parts maker, one of GM's main suppliers. The other one is Fiat, the Italian car maker. The day started off with Fiat saying that it wouldn't take part in talks orchestrated by the German government because essentially the German government had asked it to up its bid and it wasn't going to put any more money on the table because that would be too risky for Fiat. So that looked like Fiat was dropping out. It was also reported in German newspapers that Magna was having second thoughts because it was being asked to put more money on the table. But just in the last hour or so, things have turned around again. It's emerged that Magna have been having direct talks with General Motors, and it's reported by some of the news agencies that some kind of outline deal has been reached. And indeed, Germany's economy minister has said that discussions on new ideas are taking place between the two. So there are certainly a lot of hopes at the moment that some kind of deal is being hatched between General Motors and Magna International, and that later in the day there'll be a meeting involving the German government, which will be required because the German government is putting up a lot of the short-term bridging finance that's required to keep Opel in business, while the long-term details of any kind of deal for General Motors' European arm are wrapped up.
And we remind ourselves, GM Europe owns Opel and Vauxhall, have I said that correctly?
That's correct. There's Opel is the largest operation that's mainly in Germany, employs about 25,000 people in Germany, but also has factories in other countries around Europe. And then Vauxhall is the GM's arm in Britain that employs about 5,000 people, but they have the same model. So essentially it's Opel, which is called Vauxhall in the UK.
Right. And the German government is involved with the restructuring of GM Europe in the same way the U.S. government is involved here in the U.S. And we understand GM Europe employs more than 50,000 people, and half of them are in Germany, so Germany has a real interest in those employees. What does this mean? If, in fact, a deal is struck before Monday, what does it mean?
Well, over in Europe, they've been desperate to get some kind of a deal before Monday because I think it's seen that once General Motors formally declares bankruptcy, which of course is expected over the weekend or on Monday, things become a lot more complicated and it might be more difficult to ring fence the European assets from GM's creditors. And there's a worry that if GM goes down, the European arm would go down with it. So it would be a lot simpler if there was a deal specifically for the European arm, Vauxhall and Opel, before that happened. And so it was kind of more certainty about what would happen with the European operations. But of course, even then, if there is a deal, and it now seems likely that there might be, the outlook for GM's European operations are very, very uncertain. Both the bidders, Fiat and Magna, have said that they would make at least 10,000 job cuts. And of course, there's a great debate in Europe as to where those would be. And some of the non-German countries in Europe that have Opel plants are worried that a German-led deal would mean that the bulk of the axe would fall outside Germany. German plants would be protected, and that would be bad news in places like Spain, the UK, Belgium, and Poland.
So it sounds as if, whether or not there's a deal, European car workers are also looking at a lot of job losses after Monday.
They're looking at enormous numbers of job losses, at least 10,000. That's 20% of the European workforce. And the real issue now is where is the axe going to fall? And there is, as I mentioned, a lot of concern that because it's a German-led deal, that the axe will tend to fall outside Germany. Though a number of commentators make the point that if you look just purely in terms of industrial logic, where the costs are, that actually there are probably too many plants in Germany and that maybe a couple of the German plants should go. But this is a case in which politics seem to have become more significant than the underlying economics.
The BBC's business correspondent, Mark Gregory, speaking to us from London, following continually changing news about GM Europe and whether or not a deal will be struck for companies in Europe to buy GM Europe before Monday's expected bankruptcy filing by GM America. Mark, thanks so much.
No problem.
Well, as the recession deepens, more and more people are turning to this fictional American folk hero.
What's your name?
Joad. Tom Joad.
J-O-A-D.
Henry Fonda as Tom Joad in the 1940 film version of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, which is enjoying something of a renaissance. The National Endowment for the Arts says the number of grant applications for what are called big read events around The Grapes of Wrath is twice what it was last year. Now, these are community gatherings centered on books, usually put together by libraries with the government funds. The Washington Post reports that in Durham, North Carolina, people gathered to read Grapes of Wrath and hold a food drive. At the Jackson County Michigan Library, one of the Steinbeck-related events included handing out foreclosure information. The book is also being read in a classroom in Western High School in Jackson, giving kids an opening to talk about dads leaving the state to find work or kids competing with adults for summer jobs. Well, today we want to be reminded why a book written by Steinbeck decades ago is affecting people today. We're speaking with one of the country's most prominent Steinbeck scholars. Susan Schillinglaw is professor of English at San Jose State University and scholar in residence at the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas, California, John Steinbeck's hometown. And she joins us from the studios of KAZU in Monterey, California. Susan, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
And remind us, you know, the story of the Dust Bowl era sharecroppers, the Joads. Let's start with, they were forced off their drought-stricken land by the banks. And I know you have a passage there that reflects Tom Joad's thoughts about that.
Well, I think the passage also reflects this connection that people felt to the land. Steinbeck writes, "Sure," cried the tenant man, "it's our land. We measured it and broke it up. We were born on it and we got killed on it, died on it. Even if it's no good, it's still ours. That's what makes it ours, not a paper with numbers on it." And then, of course, you know, the tractors are coming and the banks are claiming ownership. And one of the representatives said, "No, you're wrong there, quite wrong there. The bank is something else than men. It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. The bank is something more than men. I tell you, it's the monster. Man made it, but they can't control it."
70 years ago. You know, we have to say, I can't imagine what it feels like to work at a bank nowadays, but that does say a lot about people who work in the bank and are out of control of what the bank seems to do.
And I think Steinbeck grasped the sense that there were all sorts of abstractions that people couldn't grasp that were creating the problem, but yet daily lives, they were suffering so much. And that yet there was this abstraction, sort of the banks or something, government, something abstract that they couldn't put a finger on.
It's funny hearing you say that word, that there was some abstraction, some sense of some us versus them, good versus bad, you know, the evil banks pushing, you know, impoverished sharecroppers off their land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people are, you know, this book is resonating today, but do you think it's the same today, or is there more of a, maybe we are them too? You know, people getting in over their heads, people taking out mortgages that they couldn't afford. It seems like the morality play is a little different today.
Well, you know, I think Steinbeck, I mean, although he's talking about the banks, I think he has a far more complex understanding of, say, the land in Oklahoma and how that dried up. I mean, the Joads themselves are responsible for some of that. They were the ones that exhausted the crops with, you know, sort of a monocrop system. And so, you know, they're not blameless. And some of them can't move on. So it's also a book about people who just refuse to change, or are just stubborn, like Muley Graves. He refuses to leave Oklahoma and says, "I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to stay here." So, you know, not every migrant in the book is admirable by far. Uncle John feels guilty and can't move on. But it's about the people who can be adaptable, who can change. And so this whole sense of survival is about people like Ma and Rosa Sharon and Tom, who learn and grow and create and can not look behind, but adapt to circumstances.
Well, and, you know, we remember the recent headlines of the 10th city that was discovered, you know, outside a town in California. So there's this resonance. Much is different. This was the Dust Bowl era. But when the Jode family gets pushed off their land by the banks, they do go to California and encounter what?
They encounter, of course, a lot of land, but the land is already owned. And so there's that great vision of California that hovers over the book, that when they get there, they will be able to have a little white house. Everybody's dream is home. And Steinbeck writes so persuasively about the dream for a home. And yet, of course, it's denied them, and slowly they lose everything. At the end, they don't even have a car or the boxcar where they've lived for a while. But yet, that sense of wanting a place is so strong in the book.
Well, we understand your favorite part of The Grapes of Wrath is chapter 25. Can you just read the last paragraph from that chapter and, you know, perhaps set it up for us?
Well, I love this chapter because it moves. It contains some of the most important movement of the book. It starts out, the spring is beautiful in California, and evokes that sense of the possibility and the dream in California. But it ends, of course, on the betrayal of that dream, because people are dying of pellagra, children, etc. And he ends, the people come with nets to fish for potatoes in the river, and the guards hold them back. They come in rattling cars to get the dumped oranges, but the kerosene is sprayed. And they stand still and watch the potatoes float by, listen to the screaming pigs being killed in a ditch and covered with quicklime, watch the mountains of oranges slop down to a putrefying ooze. And in the eyes of the people, there's a failure. And in the eyes of the hungry, there's a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage. That's, of course, where the title comes from, but I think it also approaches a sense of sort of revolutionary fervor, that unless something changes, unless there's attention paid to the suffering of the people, then the people will, you know, demand that attention be paid.
The growing wrath. You say this is as close as Steinbeck ever got to suggesting out-and-out revolution. And there's this scene from the film that hits on that as well. This is Tom Joad and Ma. Tom saying he's just going sick and tired of the treatment his family's getting as they try to find work and feed themselves.
Ma, there comes a time when a man gets mad.
You told me. You promised me.
I know, Ma.
Like
I'm
that,
a
triumph. You promised.
If there was a law they was working with, maybe we could take it. But it ain't the law. They're working away in our spirits. They're trying to make us cringe and crawl, working on our decency.
You promised, Tom.
I know. I'm a trying to, Ma. Honest, I am.
You've got to keep clear. The families are breaking up. You've got to keep clear.
What's that, a detour?
There is a detour for Tom Joad. He winds up killing a sheriff who'd brutally broken up a strike by migrant workers. Then Tom flees the family, leaving Ma. But as angry as it makes people to read this, Susan Schillinglaw says The Grapes of Wrath isn't even Steinbeck at his angriest. So when we come back, we'll talk about the social ills Steinbeck took on in his later writings. And we'll also visit with a community in Michigan that schedules modern-day events around readings of The Grapes of Wrath.
The highway is alive tonight. Nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire light with the ghost of old time Joe.
As we listen to Bruce Springsteen's nod to Tom Joad, we'll be back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back.
Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.
Henry Fonda as Tom Joad in the film version of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Today we're speaking with Susan Schilling-Law, scholar-in-residence at the National Steinbeck Center, as the Joad family is rediscovered by modern families, many attending community events called Big Reads. Now, these are funded through grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. We're going to hear more. But Susan, much changed in the U.S. after the Depression. Social safety nets were put in place. We had a sense of ourselves as Tom Joads. We'd be there to help the weak. But you remind us that Steinbeck stayed angry about the ills he saw in society. His later books were The Winter of Our Discontent, America for Americans, and then Travels with Charlie in Search of America. And I know you have a letter there he wrote with concerns about the McCarthy hearings. Tell us more.
You know, Steinbeck is known as a writer of California and Grapes of Wrath, sort of his greatest book. But he went throughout his career in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, really writing about America. I mean, he remained America's conscience, if you will. For instance, the effect on young people of the McCarthy hearings is going to be there with them all their lives. The responses to this spectacle, whatever they are going to be one of the keys to our future attitudes towards everything. If such things are not written as fiction, a whole pattern of present-day thinking and feeling will be lost.
Well, I'm also thinking of a quote from a letter he wrote in 1959 to Adlai Stevenson, who was his friend, and this was after the television game show scandal. Steinbeck writes, "If I wanted to destroy a nation, I would give it too much, and I would have it on its knees, miserable, greedy, and sick." And this is a post-war America, you know, coming out of World War II, having more material possessions than ever before, suburbia is being built. He sees what?
He's really saying, look what's happening to us. Look how we're, you know, detached from our central values. And we should change. We should do something about that. We should concern ourselves with morality. So they're kind of warnings to the country.
You also say that we can learn a lot about what Steinbeck thought by looking, as he did, at sea animals. This is fascinating. Tell us more.
His best friend during the 30s was a man named Edward Ricketts, who was a marine biologist. And Ricketts, they had shared many, many ideas, but one essay that Ricketts wrote was called Wave Shock. And basically, it's how the sea batters the inner tidal, and those animals who cling most tenaciously to the rocks, like mussels, are the ones who are, you know, battered the most ferociously. And Steinbeck took this idea, which he very much liked, and said that's, you know, similar to people. Those who suffer the most, those who are battered by circumstances, are the ones who have the, what he called the toughest survival quotient. Those are the ones who make it. And he took that idea, that sort of survival ethic, and carried it out through the next few decades of his life.
Susan Schilling-Law is professor of English at San Jose State University and scholar-in-residence at the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas, California. John Steinbeck's hometown, talking to us about the renaissance of his books. And by the way, Susan, how are you feeling about that? What are your thoughts on that? Libraries can't keep Grapes of Wrath in stock.
Well, I think Grapes of Wrath is a very appealing book. I've been to some of the big reads in Enterprise, Idaho, and Havre, Montana, and they adapt the book to the circumstances of their hometown, whether it's, you know, lumbering or logging, which is ceasing, or people out of work on the railroads. Steinbeck knew what it was like to suffer, to work, to have to rely on just family, to not have enough money to buy food. All that endures.
Well, Susan, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Well, let's bring in Marcia Young now, because she's the outreach librarian for the Jackson District Library in Jackson, Michigan. She helped bring the Grapes of Wrath Big Read to her community earlier this spring for what sounded like a month-long fair, everything from Shirley Temple movies from the 1930s to hobo parties to readings of Grapes of Wrath and family financing forums. Marcia, why did you do this? Why the Grapes of Wrath?
The Grapes of Wrath is a story that personalizes the tragedy and challenges of our nation during one of its most difficult economic periods. And with economic conditions in the state of Michigan being so poor, and many families were losing their own homes to foreclosures, we felt that was a story that people throughout the community would be able to identify with.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at one of the forums, From Dust Bowl to Now, Dealing with Difficult Times. That was held at the Universalist Unitarian Church. And how about people either hearing The Grapes of Wrath read out loud, or there were film screenings as well, seeing it? How about the people who'd never seen it before? How did they react to the work itself?
I think one of the things that they could see in reading about the Great Depression as compared to economic conditions now is that with all the safety nets in place that we now have, things aren't nearly as bad as they were. People are still winding up homeless, but they have other resources that they can turn to.
Well, and social safety nets that came out of the Depression.
Exactly.
How about the kids? How did they react? I'm looking, you had a Kit Kidridge party. That's the American Girl doll from the Depression era.
The party itself, well, it kind of focused on the positive things, you know, activities that kids back then would do, you know, attending movies, playing board games and things like that.
Well, and then they could do that while their parents went to community forums like The Face of Poverty in Jackson, A Call to Action. It strikes me such a great idea, all of these things, literature, culture, films, and social service.
Exactly. Put the focus on poverty here and now as well as back then. And basically telling people, look, this is how people got through the 1930s was social networking, you know, family and friends, and we still have that.
And plus we have some wonderful books to read, too.
Right.
That's Marcia Young. She's the outreach librarian for the Jackson District Library in Jackson, Michigan. They based a big read sort of festival around the book The Grapes of Wrath. Marcia, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
President Obama announced today that he's creating the new position of cyber czar, and separately, the Pentagon will create a new cyberspace command, all to protect the government, the military, and critical infrastructure such as banking and telecommunications from attacks on computers, which the president described as one of the most serious economic and national security challenges of the 21st century, costing the U.S. $8 billion in the last 2 years alone. Obama said that some of the threat is from Al-Qaeda.
Indeed, in today's world, acts of terror could come not only from a few extremists in suicide vests, but from a few keystrokes on the computer, a weapon of mass disruption.
Sammy Sagery is a cybersecurity expert and CEO of the Cyber Defense Agency, a consulting firm which counts the Defense Department among its clients. Sammy, how serious is this? And we know the threat isn't just Al-Qaeda, but where else is the threat from?
It's a very, very serious threat against the nation, against our critical infrastructures. And it comes from transnational terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, but also nation states such as Russia and China.
Well, and the president mentioned $8 billion lost in cyber attacks, but you cite a much bigger number.
Yeah, I think that's an underestimation. It's certainly at least that amount. In espionage alone, it's estimated that we've lost about $100 billion worth of research and development.
So we've got spies who might want information, saboteurs who want to ruin systems. You were part of a war game in 2003 called Dark Angel, which simulated an attack on the U.S. electrical grid. And you say that you demonstrated in that simulation that you could bring down the U.S. power system for 6 months. Who do you give that information to, and how do they respond?
Well, Dark Angel was actually beyond just the power grid, but that was a portion of it. And we, yes, your summary is correct, and we provided that to the National Security Council and to the and indirectly to the President of the United States through his cyber czar at the time, Dick Clark. And the response was lukewarm. I don't think they understood the gravity of the threat at the time.
Well, now the Wall Street Journal reported a few months back that Russian and Chinese cyber spies have managed to install software in the U.S. electrical grid that could bring down the system. Do we even know when someone is doing that, installing software?
No, unfortunately, our software is so complex and our ability to detect the attacks is so limited that it would be very, very difficult to determine. And we really should assume that the attacks have already been installed and are waiting to be triggered.
Well, so the president is talking about, you know, really looking deeply into this with this new office. But first, we want to be sure we've said the U.S. may be under attack, even now, by cyber attack. But is the U.S. also attacking? Is it safe to say all countries are doing this?
Well, the U.S. certainly is under attack. It's not maybe. Certainly through espionage, it's very clear that we're under attack. And yes, any nation state would be making a strategic error if it was not developing capabilities on both sides, offensively and defensively, to defend national interests.
Well, and this will get us into all sorts of civil liberty questions that I'm sure will be talked about. But as you're saying, it sounds like the president is talking about a new line of defense that's just going to be with us from here on out. Was there anything the president said that concerned you today or was overlooked in your mind?
Well, I thought the president's speech was a landmark in terms of the description of the problem. I think yet to be dealt with is the nature of the level of resources the country is going to be require to solve this problem, and also the authority levels that are going to be needed by the National Cyber Coordinator to do this job. I think coordination will be inadequate. I think he's going to have budgetary authority and the authority over the bureaucracies to get the job done.
And it's going to cost a lot of money at a time when we don't have that much left over, as it sounds like you're saying. That's Sammy Sagery, CEO of the Cyber Defense Agency, a cybersecurity consulting firm. Sammy, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. My pleasure.
And we'll have you back. And when we do come back, a cyber expert with an eye on cyber warfare, but also on internet censorship. That's in just 30 seconds here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now, and let's turn now to countries censoring websites. And when we say that, you probably think of China, Iran, North Korea. But what about Australia, France, other Western democracies, the U.S.? The Australian government is testing a so-called cyber safety plan to block internet users from accessing up to 10,000 websites. But how many other countries are doing this? John Palfrey of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-author of Access Denied, The Practice and Politics of Internet Filtering, joins us for more on that. Welcome.
Thanks, Owen.
So give us the broader picture first. Does every government do a certain amount of filtering, or is this highly unusual that a government would do this?
It's increasingly likely that a government will do some form of technical internet filtering to censor the internet. So when we first started looking at this closely in about 2002, we found a couple governments around the world doing it seriously, Saudi Arabia and China as two examples. We've been studying the growth since then, and now there are more than 36 countries around the world that do very extensive filtering for lots of topics. But it's also the case that most countries do some form of it. So the United States, for instance, does some filtering in schools and libraries. So we see it in lots of corners of the world in varying degrees.
What is the U.S. censoring?
So there are a number of different approaches taken by schools and libraries. They're meaning to protect children, of course, in these cases, and they're doing it to protect themselves from having federal funding and other things taken away from them. So it's very often protecting kids from sites where we think it will impact their morality one way or another.
Right, so pornography or others. And that's sort of that little opening that worries freedom of speech on the internet advocates who think, who decides what morality is?
That's exactly right. So in a broadband connection that one has in one's home, you can choose what you want to access on the internet here in the United States. But when you go down the road of saying somebody else makes those choices at a place other than in your home, then you have quite a different situation.
Right. We should say that there are parents who might be thrilled about that because their concern is that their child is going to go to the library and access things that they may not be able to access at home.
It's absolutely right. There's a very serious public policy issue here, which is that for some kids, the libraries and schools are the only places they can get on the internet, and some parents would rather that the locus parenti there would, in fact, stop them from accessing those sites.
Right. Go a little broader. You know, what are other countries doing before we learn what Australia is doing now?
So the big stories in this space, honestly, are places like China and Iran and Uzbekistan, to choose three from different regions of the world. These are countries which, over the last several years, have developed incredibly sophisticated ways to block internet access at lots of different levels and to lots of different kinds of sites. So politically sensitive material in each of those countries is blocked from users. They also find ways to block search engine results. They will monitor your usage in cyber cafes and so forth. That's the kind of thing we don't see in the West. If you then look, though, to places like France and Germany, for instance, you see blockage of Nazi paraphernalia, for instance, or propaganda. You see in some of the Nordic countries child pornography blocking of various forms that's done by the state.
We understand the Middle East, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, but other countries and North Africa, there's a lot of filtering targeting political speech?
That's right. So the places that target political speech really are three regions of the world. You mentioned the Middle East and North Africa. That's the primary region because there's so many states that do it there. East Asia with China as a hub, Vietnam famously does. And then some of the former Soviet states in the CIS do a fair amount of this blocking. I think of Uzbekistan as the hub there. So in those places, political speech is also blocked by the state.
By the way, how does it work? If you're a U.S. citizen now traveling more and more to Vietnam, direct flights and everything, and you brought your own personal computer, will the Vietnamese filtering system block you if you brought your computer in from outside?
Sure will. I've been to Vietnam recently. You're in a Western-style hotel or a Vietnamese hotel, doesn't much matter. You still need an on-ramp to the Internet. And the way that most of this filtering happens is that the state has said to those who provide Internet access, you need to block access when somebody asks for certain things, or importantly, block someone from publishing stuff in a certain way. So with my American, you know, Mac laptop, I can't get on to the same things that the Vietnamese are being blocked from.
Huh. Well, let's go to Australia's latest efforts. What are they doing and why are they doing it?
They've decided that they're going to experiment with using internet filtering as a way to block things, starting with child pornography. And we'll see what happens. This is early days yet with this system. But I think a lot of freedom of speech and privacy experts are worried that this is the thin end of the wedge, that a place like Australia would put in place such a system on a topic where, of course, we all agree that child pornography is abhorrent.
Well, then someone has to make the decision further what's pornographic. Sometimes political speech is pornographic to someone. And I'm thinking of how in Australia, a company called Electronic Frontiers Australia took the links off its website because the government threatened to impose fines of $11,000 a day under this system that we've been talking about. And Electronic Frontiers Australia had links to a U.S. site called Abortion TV that showed aborted fetuses. And that was going to be blocked or at least fined by the Australian government.
That's right. So one of the big issues with internet censorship is the censor has to pick. They have to pick overbroad or underbroad, and neither one is any good. They have to choose to say, we're going to miss a lot of stuff. That's the underbroad approach. So we know that we'll block something we don't like. Let's imagine Playboy.com is something you don't want people to see. You put Playboy.com on the list, and then you leave off Penthouse.com or some other example, right? Mm-hmm. That's an underbroad approach, but you know that you'll just get what you want. Otherwise, you say, I want to block anything that has the word breast in it somehow because we think that that might be pornographic, that famously, of course, that will miss breast cancer sites, for instance.
Sure.
And so no matter how you look at this, you have to choose underbroad or overbroad in the censorship regime. And it's one of the reasons it's constitutionally infirm to do that in the United States.
Well, we understand that the U.S. Congress actually supports funds for groups that want to circumvent blocking in other countries. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. So there's been a program over the last several years administered through the State Department whereby the U.S. government gives some money to help support systems that help somebody get around these blocking. So an example would be a wonderful program based in Toronto called Siphon. This is a way in which somebody can circumvent the blocking that they might experience in a state like China or Iran.
Like the group Falun Gong.
That's right. So Falun Gong has been very active in supporting this kind of funding for these tools that allow people to do the circumvention. Why? Because, of course, Falun Gong is censored in China by the government, and they seek for their own members and for others to be able both to publish information and to access it.
Well, couldn't that be a two-way street, though? Another government might support funding of getting around a ban in the U.S.
There's no doubt. With each of these topics, it's a neutral technology we're talking about, and you can use it for all manner of different purposes. So what we're seeing is states getting in the business of fighting over access to information and how you get around different blockages. The U.S. government has been talking a great deal about how this is the new zone of warfare, and I think what we're going to continue to see is attacks of the literal sort, where allegedly the Chinese has attacked the United States, the Russians, the Estonians, and so forth, but also this quieter war where it's the game of letting activists get access to things, circumventing some, blocking others, and our different countries are playing different aspects in this war.
What do you think should happen? Countries really are struggling to protect children from pornography. And yet we've just heard of all the different things that can result from blocking access to the internet. What do you think is one of the solutions?
So as the dad of two young kids, 7 and 3, and I really want them to use the internet in constructive ways, and I really want them to stay safe, I think the decision-making for that really belongs as locally as you can possibly make it. So I think parents and teachers have the largest obligation here. Parents should run filters on local computers that they have in their home, or teachers in schools in different ways. And we should give kids the skills that they need to navigate around this increasingly complicated information ecosystem. But there is no way at a state level, at a country level, to do a good job of filtering, censoring the internet right now in a technical fashion, and I think it's a really bad policy.
Harvard Law Professor John Palfrey of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, co-author of the book Access Denied, The Practice and Politics of Internet Filtering. John, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, hearandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast. That's hearandnow.org. And before we go today, the president sings. So does Katie Couric and Joe Biden. Thanks to AutoTunes and the Gregory Brothers. You have to hear this. You're listening to Hear and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now, and let's get some of your thoughts in. Many of you wrote after our Memorial Day piece on the mental health problems of World War II vets, which have been largely airbrushed from history. Ken Portnoy of Marblehead, Massachusetts, says, "Thank you for such a moving story. I was reminded of my uncle. I was always begging him to tell me anything of his wartime experiences, and he said only one sentence, only one time. It was after I'd been to Normandy for the 50th anniversary of the D-Day landings. I said to him, 'You must have seen quite a bit.' His reply, 'I saw a lot of dead Americans.'"
When I started, I had, of course, all these notes I had been saving since prep school days.
And our conversation with author Robert Manson Myers about his forthcoming book, Ars Amatoria, in which every word begins with A, sent a lot of you to the bookstore. So sorry, it hasn't been published yet. But to get on a waiting list, go to our website, hearandnow.org. And to get an idea of what a loquacious character in the Charlotte, North Carolina area he is, we share this memory from Edla Brabham.
"When the interview began, I realized that your guest was the gentleman I've described to my friends as Professor X, with whom I once had an extended conversation outside the post office. We spoke about BBC versions of English classics, his home in London, the Philistines who surround one in provincial Charlotte, one's teaching days at Yale. I asked his name. With a dismissive wave of his hand, Professor X said, 'Names aren't important.' I never knew his name until now. Since our conversation, I've seen Professor Myers in other places, and I am able to report that he does not keep a low profile."
Let's get one more in. We also spoke recently with jobs counselor Beth Kobliner about 20-somethings heading for the workforce. She said, among other things, that young people know more about Tom Cruise's child than the interest rate on their credit cards, and they were holding out for dream jobs that don't exist. Well, Rory Gillick, a 2007 graduate of the University of Wisconsin, was listening in his car in Milwaukee doing his job as a messenger. He's on the line. Rory, you felt what at that moment?
I was mildly upset.
Because you're driving in the car as a messenger. Was that your dream job?
No, it was not. It was the first job that I'd gotten out of college, and it was 8 months after I graduated.
You took it because what? You have debt to pay?
Yes. I left school with over $20,000 in debt. You know, I just had to start making payments on my loans.
Right.
Ms. Kobline had mentioned credit card debt. And that was another thing that kind of made me laugh. I don't know too many people my age with the luxury of even having credit card debt. I am familiar with Surrey Cruise. Ms. Kobliner was correct about that. But I certainly have my head farther up into my finances than I do into that sort of thing.
Rory, thanks so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
To send your thoughts on the program, go to hearandnow.org and click on Contact Us. Back to the news, and there's been a lot of it. Recession, several conflicts, swine flu. You'd never want to make fun of it by, say, converting President Obama's spoken words into a rap song, would you?
We are ready to lead once more. Pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, begin remaking America.
Well, yes, you would if you were the Gregory brothers, three musical brothers and one sister-in-law. They use a program called Auto-Tune to change the pitch of famous voices. The youngest of the brothers, Michael Gregory, joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Michael, how did you start this?
Well, I used to produce pop albums while I was in school, and I used a lot of auto-tune on the singers. And so after late nights of tuning in the studio, I would start to hear everything in perfect semitones. If the security guard was kicking me out of the studio, he would sound like he was in a magical opera, and he was, you know, singing some sort of aria about how I needed to get out. And then when I went back to my room, my roommate would be talking about his e-contest. It sounded like he was singing, so it was really just taking that extra step and applying that to news anchors and politicians.
And do you have a favorite?
I have a couple favorites. Katie Couric, you can't go wrong with, because her voice is so clear. Anything she says sounds like she's singing.
Well, let's listen, actually. We have some Katie Couric. This one, if you could visualize a split screen with CBS news anchor Katie Couric on one side, very seriously delivering the news, at least in her appearance, and your brother Andrew on the other side of the screen. He's sort of the fake guest. And he's reacting, actually he's overreacting, to her news of Arctic ice caps melting. Again, this is through Auto-Tune. Let's listen.
At the North Pole, new satellite photos show Arctic ice is melting so fast.
Oh snap, how fast?
Many scientists now predict it won't be gone within 30 years.
Surely you just, I'm on the cardiac arrest.
Some researchers think it could disappear.
Your brother there holding his face under cardiac arrest. We also understand that you were very much inspired and are very much inspired by Vice President Joe Biden.
When he gives a speech, he is almost unrivaled in his singing voice.
There will continue to be job losses the remainder of this year. The question is, will they continually go down before they begin to rebound? Before they begin to rebound?
What are we seeing there?
So we are replacing some CNN interviewers, Sarah, my sister-in-law, and me, and our heads are bobbing up and down just listening to him, and then we're so inspired by his speaking that we start singing along.
Well, we should say that you've also auto-tuned historical figures, Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King, and this one is actually quite sweet. You're not mocking in any way. At the YouTube site, people say they tear up over this. In this tune of Martin Luther King, you see people reacting to his I Have a Dream speech on the Mall in Washington. Let's listen.
I have a dream today. My children will not be judged by the color of their skin. This is our home. I have a dream. The rough places will be made plain.
Boy, talk about a voice with music in it.
Yeah, he is the greatest unintentional singer that there ever will be.
Yeah, it's just quite pretty. Well, we should say that this is a side project. You and your siblings actually spend most of your time writing music that doesn't involve newscasters and politicians. You have an EP. It's called Meet the Gregory Brothers and Sister-in-Law. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you deal with that.
But yeah, we don't know yet either.
But here's a little of West Coast time. Your brother Evan is on lead.
When I stay up too late, you'll still be away out there, West Coast time.
Michael?
Yes?
That's very nice, but it's not funny.
I'm sorry. We'll get on that.
Are you concerned, though, that people are, wow, the Gregory brothers have a new EP coming out, and people are going to be poised for hilarity?
It wasn't a worry we had a month ago, you know? I mean, nobody was thinking about that.
But now you're a YouTube sensation, so you may have to explain. This is your day job.
Yeah.
That's Michael Gregory of the Gregory Brothers. The name of the new EP coming out is called Meet the Gregory Brothers. And to see their YouTube mashups, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the producer of this story was our intern, Jesse Martin. Jesse, this is your last day. Best to you in whatever you do. And thank you for letting me feel like Cher. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. And join us again here and now.